Welcome to the Money is Emotional podcast with Christine Lucan, the financial dignity coach. In this podcast, we help you recover a positive and peaceful relationship with your personal finances. We do this by bringing together wise money management with emotional intelligence. Join us for this journey where we navigate our relationship with money as Christine Lucan draws from years of experience and guest experts to help you get to the root of your money issues.
Hello, my friend, and welcome to the Money is Emotional podcast. I am your host, Christine Lucan. Today's episode is Becoming a Profitable Landlord. I am so super excited to welcome today's special guest, my friend, life and business strategist, Mark Dolfini. Mark is a veteran of the U.S. Marines and the author of 3 books. He is currently writing his 4th book, The Time Wealthy Advantage. He coaches landlords and other entrepreneurs to run their businesses efficiently and profitably. Mark lives in Lafayette, Indiana, with his beautiful wife, Jennifer, and their 3 children, Leland, Logan, and Liliana. Welcome to the show, Mark.
Thanks. It's really good to see you.
So you're a girl dad now.
I
How
am.
How does that feel?
Terrifying.
It's been you and the boys for a while, right?
It has. It's been, Leland just graduated from high school. He's 18, graduated midterm. Logan is 15 and Liliana is just over 1. So she just cleared her first birthday. And it's not getting any less terrifying. It's going the other way, if anything.
Well, I her pictures are so adorable on Facebook. I can't imagine that it would be terrifying.
She is a lot. She is a huge personality. So mama the other day, she wasn't sleeping. So she brought her downstairs just to kind of see if she can get her settled down. And she sat her on the bed and she just wanted a party. She just laughed and giggled and mama realized really quickly that was a terrible idea and took her back up to her room. It's fun.
Well, as much as we could probably talk about the kids for period of time, we're really here to talk about something else. But before we really dive into our topic of being a profitable landlord, I'd love for you to tell us your story about how you got started in the real estate business, because you had a rocky start as a landlord, didn't you?
Yeah, I did it all to myself. That was the problem. I would love to blame anybody else for all the mistakes that I made. But when I wrote my the last book that I wrote, The Time Wealthy Investor 2.0, and you had a little hand in that in the very beginning, so I appreciate your help and counsel on that, because you have written several books yourself, and which are all amazing, by the way. She did not tell me to say this, but I reference her books all the time, and they're right there within reach in case I need to get there. Yeah, because you're and I coach a lot of people now, but they're very interested in seeing my story. They're very interested because they see the completed product on the other side of, oh wow, you only work an hour a week and you have all these rental units, and I have a property management business which has about 250 units altogether, and I spend about an hour a week, you know, in that business.
Yeah.
And now that's the good side. That's what you see after, you know, all the work. But getting started in this, I was at Purdue. And when I first got out of the Marine Corps, came to Indiana to go to Purdue, and I started buying rental units while I was still in school. And I learned how the banks were underwriting loans. So once I figured that out, it wasn't difficult to basically show them what they needed to say yes to the loans. And so by the time I had graduated from college, between what I was able to buy with traditional financing and what I was able to get just from my own wheeling and dealing and everything, I had about a dozen rental units altogether before I actually left school.
That's impressive.
Thanks. Yeah. And I was actually pretty proud of that. I mean, the properties I was buying were not super impressive. They were, you know, in the community, we call them crack shacks, you know, they were they were not great.
I guess you got to start somewhere, right?
Exactly. They were not great. But I did learn a lot about the business. And early on, the part of the problems, which you're going to hear me say, you know, at least reference at least another couple times, is that when I was buying these properties, I never budgeted in my line items, in my individual line items on my pro forma or my income statement for jobs that I didn't want to do. So in other words, for every line item I didn't budget for, it became a job I created for myself. So if I didn't budget for mowing, I just created a mowing job for myself, right? If I didn't budget for maintenance or leasing, you know, going out and showing the properties, well, guess what? That's a job I created for myself. And a lot of people, I know in my particular case, part of the problems where I got started was I was just looking at, okay, well, what's the mortgage payment and how much rent can I get? And that's going to be my net. And it is not that straightforward. So, so by the time I left Purdue, I have an accounting background. So I went and worked for the Marriott for a few years, which was a fantastic company to work for. But once you're kind of bitten by that entrepreneurial bug, you just never really want to, it's hard not to go back. You know, you stay there. So I was building rental property portfolio. And by the time when I fully went on it, because 9/11 had happened and I was just like, I'm just not feeling super fulfilled. I was working some corporate jobs here and there, just different things in the field of accounting. But ultimately I was building my rental portfolio and I got up to 92 rental units by myself.
Wow.
And it was a little over $6.5 million of real estate. And while that might sound impressive, it was built on a house of cards. And that was the real problem, is that I had created not just a job for myself, but hundreds and hundreds of little jobs for myself because I didn't budget appropriately for those individual tasks.
Yeah. And so I know your story. I know where that led you, but I'd love for you to tell our listeners what doing landlording the wrong way, where you end up when you go down that path.
Yeah. So most people and I operated under a banner called Landlord Coach for a while, and then I kind of shifted, I niched up a little bit to working with more small business entrepreneurs. But under the Landlord Coach banner, I would often tell my stories where I would travel around different real estate investor association meetings and just travel around and kind of tell my story. And it was inevitable when people would find out, oh, you're the Landlord Coach. Yeah, I really want to get some rental units. And I'm like, oh, okay, that's great. And many of them, what I would find is they were stuck usually somewhere between like 7 and 15. They were always stuck at that weird number. Mm-hmm. And they were always saying, well, if I could only get the financing, you know, if I could only get the financing, they think that that's the financing that's the problem. But it's actually not. More oftentimes it's because they're constrained by capacity, because they have so many little jobs that they created for themselves, whether it was showing properties, cleaning properties, you know, whatever it was, all these little things, right? Now magnify that times 92. Managing 92 properties is not 92 times more difficult than one. It's like they're in orders of magnitude. It's like the Richter scale, right? So by the time you get to 92, it's like 9,000 times more difficult just because of the multiple levels of complexity that you have to manage.
Right.
So to answer your question, to tell that story, what ended up happening was the 2008 came along, and I head into 2008 with, you know, if you listen to Rich Dad Poor Dad, plenty of good debt, and I use that air quotes, good debt. So from a percentage perspective, not to geek out on numbers, but I'm kind of a numbers person. So if I'm looking at my rental portfolio, I had $6.5 million of rental real estate with about $6 million worth of debt. Okay. So my loan to value, I was pretty high on loan to value, and I had about maybe $200,000 or so on unsecured debt. So my good debt to bad debt ratio was pretty darn good.
Yeah.
But it's the overall debt load that killed me. And honestly, it was the unsecured debt that killed me more than anything else. So really the good debt, bad debt, it wouldn't have mattered, because even if I didn't have any of the unsecured debt, it still would have killed me just because I was way over leveraged. That was the one problem. The other problem was I was over leveraged in time. So that's why I wrote a book called The Time Wealthy Investor, because I had created so many of these little jobs for myself that when I was bringing in about $60,000 a month in rent revenues, which, you know, on its surface sounds, oh my gosh, this kid's crushing it. The reality was it was so over leveraged that when 2008 came along, the labor market got wiped out, and that $60,000 a month went to about $30,000 a month. And ooh. I just couldn't weather that storm. I mean, I was in foreclosure on most of those properties in about 8 months.
Wow. Well, and not just that, but you also had a lot of crushing stress because you also ended up in the hospital.
Yes.
Too.
Yep. Yeah, I did.
So and tell us about that.
So, not to be outdone, right? I was in the Marine Corps. I was like, oh, okay, I can just work through this. I'm going to work hard. I'm going to grind hard. And I was already working 16, 18 hours a day. So I, you know, get up at 6, work until the other 6, keep working until like 10 or 11 at night, and then somehow drag myself out of bed and do it all again. And I did that 7 days a week. Well, with all these people not paying, I had all these properties to turn and just trying to get it all done. So I went from working 16 to 18 hours a day to roughly 20 to 22 hours a day. And that was day after day after day. And I would just grab a nap wherever I could, like the Lowe's parking lot, you know, the stoplight, wow. You know, wherever I could. And it doesn't take long for something like that to catch up to you in your body. And that's exactly what happened. So I ended up getting a cold. It was a simple cold.
Yeah.
And I did the right thing. I actually went to the doctor, which I never did. So I went to the doctor, you know, the doctor said, here, take this medicine, go get some rest. You'll be fine in a couple of days. So of course I took the medicine, went back to work and didn't get rest. Right. Did not rest. And, in about 3 days, that simple cold turned into double pneumonia.
Oh, wow.
And the only way that I could actually breathe was to put pressure against my chest, like by leaning over the back of a chair and hunching over. It's the only way I could actually get air into my lungs because
my God.
Lungs were basically collapsing. So I got to the hospital and give me a breathing treatment. And of course, as I'm sitting there, I'm waiting in this room by myself. And they put me in this triage room, you know, they ordered this breathing treatment and they just left. I didn't get anything. I'm just laying there.
Oh,
and,
my God.
And I'm all of a sudden I'm starting to I'm feeling like I'm mouthing for air, like a fish out of water.
Yeah.
And I'm like, why am I like, I'm not getting enough air. Right. And I'm starting to freak out, but I'm like also super present and super calm. All this was happening. Like you'd think like you would freak out during that moment. Right.
Right.
But I was so incredibly present. And then all of a sudden the room started to close in because I wasn't getting enough oxygen.
Oh geez.
I was getting hypoxic. And as I'm laying there, I'm thinking, I'm gonna die, and no one's gonna be here. Like they left me. Like there's no one in the room with me.
Yeah.
And so I just kind of very calmly, just kind of resolved myself to my fate. Like, wow, this is how I'm going out. I literally worked myself to death. Wow. So I was kind of getting ready to close my eyes, what I thought would be the last time, and then felt someone kind of fitting a mask over me and getting me this breathing treatment and everything else. And I would say it was scary, but it was scarier after the fact.
Yeah.
Because I was so incredibly calm during that moment, but I literally almost worked myself to death. And the hospitalist who came in later on, and I was like, of course, I'm feeling better now that I got a breathing treatment and everything else. And I'm like, okay, I'm ready to go. And she's like, no, this is exactly where you need to be. Otherwise, you're going to be back here in a day or two, way worse off. So this is exactly where you need to be. But she looked at me before she left and she said, you know, people who look like you at your age, and I was 37 at the time, people who look like you at your age don't lay in hospital beds like this. So you really need to look at what's going on in your life. And she didn't know anything about my stress of my life or anything else.
Right.
So that is the bad side of really how bad it really can get in terms of all the work that I was doing and the stress I was putting on myself.
Yeah. But there's a happy ending.
Yeah.
there's a happy ending. You went from working, you know, 20 to 22 hours a day to working 1 hour a week. So my next question is, you know, what are one or two of the most common mistakes that landlords make? And maybe, of course, you made them too and go into a little bit more detail in their business that adversely affects the profitability. And you can also talk about the free time and the mental health as well.
Yeah, let's look at it from, because let's face it, this is a business type show. So let's hit that first, because I think that's obviously important. But the other side of this is I'm also a very vision based, very strategic, begin with the end in mind sort of guy. So I'll hit that second. The first answer is most people, they don't underwrite the properties correctly. So they either vastly overestimate the revenues, right? If you're looking at pro forma, it's just like an income statement where you've got revenues and your projected revenues and your projected expenses. Most people vastly overestimate the rents coming in and they vastly underestimate the expenses going out. Mm-hmm. So usually what I hear, and I hear this in the Airbnb world too, where people are like, oh my gosh, you could buy that property that might get $2,000 a month in rent, but I could Airbnb it. And I'm going to get $6,000 a month in rent. And that sounds great until they realize all the expenses are also going to be proportionately higher.
Right.
So you really have to do the appropriate underwriting on both sides. So, and speaking as an underwriter, I want to look at that. I want to do a sensitivity analysis to say, okay, if those numbers don't work out this way, if you are buying it as an Airbnb, if it doesn't function as an Airbnb, how else could this operate? How else will this work? If this doesn't work as a traditional rental, could we do something different? Could we do a room share, or could we do a short-term rental or an Airbnb situation, something like that? But you always have to approach this not just in one aspect, because if you do, you kind of paint yourself into a corner. And that's what I see with a lot of folks who buy properties, and for all of those individual line items that I talked about, they don't budget for them. So for example, a lot of times where I hear, and people are watching other podcasts, I don't necessarily need to say who they are, mm-hmm. but it's a very real estate focused podcasts. And they say, oh, well, put 5% on there for CapEx. Okay. So let's unpack CapEx a little bit. Okay.
Say, what's CapEx?
So CapEx is capital expenditure. Yeah. So capital expenditure would be those items where you're going to improve your furnace, you'll replace your furnace, replace your roof or something along those lines, right? So if you're watching the very popular podcast, it's like, oh, we'll throw 5% on there. Okay, so let me back into this in terms of just some logic, okay? Let's say we have two exact houses, okay? And two exact houses in Cincinnati, okay? And one house is, they're both very similar in terms of layout, right? So they both have four bedrooms, they both have two baths, but the difference is one is new, say it was built in the last 2 years, and one is 30 years old. Okay. So would it stand to reason that the newer property generally would probably command higher rent?
Yeah.
It would stand to reason, right?
Yeah.
There's certain areas where more historical homes might pull in more money, but there's a reason a more modern property probably would pull in more rent, right? Whereas the older property would pull in less rent. So let's say the new property pulls in $4,000 a month, and the older property in the same similar area pulls in $3,000 a month. Okay. Well, if you go by what these other shows are saying, or these other, and a lot of gurus teach this too, which I'm going to tell you why I don't agree with it. If you use 5%, say for capital expenditure, okay, you say 5% of rent. Okay. So I'm going to say, okay, so I'm going to set aside 5% of $4,000 for the new property, which is $200 a month. Okay. So if I've got a new house, why am I setting aside more money for the new house versus the, I'm going to set aside less money for the older house for CapEx?
Right.
It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense at all. Mm-hmm. So why not just do it mathematically? It's a very simple calculation, extremely simple. Generally, if you've got a furnace, right? It's I'm gonna get a little math heavy here, so everybody just I'll do it slowly. But if you, let's say you have a furnace, okay, and the furnace, the average useful life of a furnace is 25 years, okay. If you're 10 years into that furnace, you have 15 years left on that furnace, right? That's your first calculation. That's all you need to know. And you can verify that extremely easily, right? So you got 15 years left on that furnace. Out of a 25-year term, you're in 10 years in, you got 15 years left. If the price of a furnace today is $8,000, You just divide it by 15. And now you've got your annual CapEx. And if you want a monthly CapEx, divide that by 12. And now you've got a monthly, a real number that you can hang your hat on. That's not, oh, I'll just put 5% down on CapEx. Another one that drives me crazy is vacancy expense, right? Mm-hmm. And because you're going to get eaten alive on vacancy expense. What people don't consider is that vacancy expense is not, it's even though it's measured in dollars, it's actually a measurement of time.
Yeah.
Right. So if you think about that, when most people are trying to figure this out, they say, oh, well, I'm just going to put 10% on vacancy. Okay. So what you're telling me is it's going to take you 1.2 months. If you're saying 10%, it's going to take you 1.2 months to go from no dollars to turn the property, find someone else, screen them, and then back to dollars in 1.2 months. Yeah. Right.
Not which, likely.
Maybe, maybe not. I mean, it just depends. Like, but you're right. Sometimes it's, especially if this is their side hustle, because I can tell you there's plenty of people like, oh, the property's vacant. Yeah, it's been vacant for 2 weeks. I guess we should probably go over there and see what the condition of it is, which is
right.
Ask me how I know.
And clean it and get somebody in to fix the drywall and
paint
the carpets.
Exactly. And all those things. So a lot of people will put 5% on CapEx. Now, keep in mind, that's also 10% per year. So in other words, if it's like, okay, so if your average vacancy, let's say for a home, right, in my market, it's very uncommon to turn over every single year in a home, right? In my market, that's very typical. Las Vegas might be different. You know, Cincinnati might be different. Like, these are all different properties, right, in different markets. But if it's, let's say for argument's sake, you're saying, well, the property is going to take me, sure, it's going to take me 1.2 months to turn over, but it's going to be vacant every other year. Well, that's a 5% vacancy rate, right?
Yeah.
So that would mean you'd set aside 5% of your rent towards your vacancy expense, right? And these are the sorts of things like when people just start setting aside numbers, they don't really actually think what they represent. You know, things like maintenance and repairs and cleaning and mowing and the utilities when the property is vacant and snow removal or, you know, all those things, even though they say, no, the resident will take care of that. Well, what happens when the place is empty, right? So walking through all of those expenses is probably one of the things that I see the most commonly missed things when people are saying, well, my cash flow, my properties is terrible and I don't know why. Okay, well, let's take a look at it. And almost always it's because they under budgeted for those things.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me. Yes, you. Thank you so much for listening to the Money is Emotional podcast. We hope you're enjoying it so far. If you have any questions or would like to talk more about this topic, you can find us at www.christinelukin.com, and all of our social media platforms are listed in the show notes.
Yeah, so it really is about crunching the numbers, but it's not pulling those numbers out of thin air.
Yeah, they got to be meaningful, right?
Right.
Yeah, they've got to represent something that is relevant to what it is, you know, how the property will operate. And and if they don't do that, that leads to my second point, is that when they don't set aside enough money to, or no money, right? So if they don't budget for it at all, or they don't budget enough for it, for leasing expense, for example, if they don't budget for a person to go show the property, then guess what? Now they have just created a leasing job, and that's what they get to do on Saturdays and Sundays, right?
Right.
And when people go, hey, I'm in front of the property right now. I saw the sign. I'm in front of the property right now. Can you come and show it to me? I'm really interested, right? And that's exactly when you'll be sitting in your lounge chair on a Sunday. It's 5:30. You can smell the pot roast that's getting ready to be served. And you're like, oh, this place has been vacant for 2 months. I have got to go right now. And you drive across town and they won't be there. Ask me how I know. So,
because you've been there.
Yeah. I'd love to say that I've got this all right so many times. And I was born on the third of the month and call it a triple or whatever. That is not my experience. So the thing is that you've got to be careful of all these little jobs that you're going to create for yourself. Look, if you're okay with it, if you're like in retirement, and you're like, man, I need something to do. Even then I would be cautioned to say, look, but is this still the best use of your time versus spending time with grandkids or traveling or reading a book or staring at a blank wall, anything than creating these hundreds of miserable jobs for yourself.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like a lot of people don't go into real estate with a good solid plan. You know, it's like they think, oh, I need to diversify my money. So, you know, so-and-so has got this duplex for rent. And rather than have all my money in the stock market, I'm going to do this. And they kind of, you know, happen into it almost accidentally, or they'll do something like, oh, I'm going to buy this duplex because my son is going to college next year and he's going to live in half of it and he'll manage the property. But then when push comes to shove, you know what happens? The kid decides, oh, I don't want to go to this, to that school. I want to go to this school out of state. And next thing you know, you've got two vacant units and now it's all your responsibility.
And sometimes that does work out, you know, sometimes it does, but when it doesn't, now you've got this property. And I have several different people who I manage properties for that they just paid too much for them and their cash flow has been horrible. And I'm like, look, not only did you pay too much for them, now you can't afford to do the maintenance. So, you know, we end up trying to work with them a little bit to float that. But, you know, I'm not going to do that to a certain, I can only do that to a certain degree because, you know, I don't want to put, I mean, I've still got to make sure that we're, you know, we're viable. And if I do that to all the properties, then all of a sudden that could leave us in a bad cash position. But yeah, it's a very desperate thing that people find themselves in. And then when they were coming out of 2013, and it was really good to be a property manager in 2013, and back in 2019, the property management world saw a population explosion once again, because there was the highest percentage of landlords that had been out there, not just in population, but also in percentage. And there was a very, very large percentage of non-owner occupied dwellings out there. So of course, it opened up the world for people who wanted to get into the property management hustle, but And many of them are gone, by the way. I mean, the people got in, tried to make money, and then they realized, oh my gosh, this is terrible. Why would someone willingly sign up for this? But it is only difficult when you don't have the infrastructure, when you don't have the processes set up, and it can get very, very, it can be a miserable job that you create for yourself if you're not careful.
Yeah. Well, and this leads into my next question, because, you know, being a landlord does mean that you are a business owner.
Right.
And things like systems are very important. So what tips can you give to be, quote, time wealthy, as you call it, that would apply, of course, to landlords, but to any business owner?
Yeah. Well, that goes back to the second point I was making, is that, you know, you have to begin with the end in mind. You have to figure out, like, okay, start to construct a vision for what you're actually wanting to create. And I would say, I would make the argument to start with your personal vision first. Most people find it very easy, and I suspect a lot of business owners and entrepreneurs do watch your show, because you do give such sound financial advice. And that was, in fact, that was your second book that you wrote mostly towards the freelancer, right? If I'm not mistaken, that was Manage Money Like a Boss.
Yep.
See, I knew there was going to be a test.
You passed the test.
She did not tell me to say that, by the way. But that was all about freelancers and the struggle that the freelancer has, that, you know, and it's been a minute since I've been through the book. But the point about that is to start out with the end in mind in terms of what you want this business to accomplish for you.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the day, if you're just doing it to stay busy, then fine, treat it like a hobby, and that's fine. No one's going to criticize you for it. But then you don't get to complain when all of your time goes to that, because you have no other choice,
right?
And you can create this self-imposed prison. So starting out, the advice I would say is, you know, start with the end in mind in terms of what it is that you're actually trying to accomplish. And it's really funny that when I would travel around to those different REIA groups, the real estate investment groups, they would say, oh, I have some buy and hold properties. That's what I'm going to be talking about today. They're like, oh yeah, I want to get into some buy and hold properties too. And like, yeah, I want to get, and it was always increments of 25. I want to get 100 rental units, or I want to get 75 rental units. Again, always increments of 25. I have no idea why. And I would say, like, oh wow, okay. And then I would say, well, 99 wouldn't do it. You have to have exactly 100. And they'd say, well, no, I mean, you know, 99 would do it. I mean, 100's a round number, you know. I'm like, I get it. I have an accounting background. I get it. 100's a round number, but but 97 wouldn't do it. Like, I mean, 97 is a prime number. Would that do it? And they're like, yeah, 97 would do it. You know, then I'd go to 91 and 89 and they'd keep going down. And what they eventually, many of them would recognize is that what they were doing is they were confusing the level, the number of rental units. They were confusing the number of rental units with the level of life output they think that that was going to buy them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. So if you're really thinking about doing this, excuse me, if you're thinking about doing this, really stop and think, okay, well, if I said, on the other hand, okay, I really want to get $27,911.13 every month. Have you thought that through? Yeah, I would argue that you've thought pretty clearly on that, right? So with that, and what difference would it make if it was 100 rental units or 17 rental units that were paid in full?
Yeah, that's a good point.
Right? Right. Because you're going to massively reduce the amount of complexity in your life. And then you can say, okay, like, why not? What difference does it make? I would rather spend my time figuring out which cruise I was going to take next. Or even if it was something, maybe something that you wanted to do just to be more industrious, and you could say, okay, cool. That part of my life funds something over here, which is a true passion for me, which is where I'm at right now. I've got, you know, my rental property business, my property management business, that funds my ability to do this and not be interrupted 71 times because my phone is ringing.
Right.
So,
exactly.
So you can, it opens you up to other things, but again, begin with the end in mind, start with your personal vision, then create a business vision. Many, many people will often start with a business vision and because the business vision is easy. Well, I want 100 rental units, or I want, you know, whatever the thing is, right? I want to flip houses, or I want to, you know, sell, you know, lotions or potions or whatever it is. But whatever the thing is, what ends up happening is when you create a business vision before you create a personal vision, you end up creating a life that exists to serve the business.
Yeah.
And that sucks. Again, ask me how I know.
Yeah. Well, and then I think that really gets into the business vanity metrics, like saying, yeah, oh, I have 100 rental units. I mean, it's like the business coach that brags about, you know, having $100,000 sales months, but literally only clearing $5,000 after they've paid all their advertising expenses, et cetera. And it's like, okay, let's look at the bottom line. Like, what is this adding to your life? And so I think that's basically what you're saying is, what do you want this to add to your life? And look at it from that perspective. So I love that. So you and I could talk for forever. I have one final question to ask you. Tell us about your VIP method course for landlords. I looked at the sales page the other day, and the amount of knowledge and tools that it includes for the price is like mind-blowing.
Thanks. I stacked a lot of stuff in there just because I recognize there's a lot of people who really do want to do it themselves. It's almost like they would rather fail by doing it themselves than succeeding with help. Again, I get that. That was me from 26 to 39. That was me. and I totally get that. And I'm not here to knock anybody about that, but I would also encourage you. It's okay that you get someone to help you. That's totally fine. So in terms of the VIP method, that is what I use for all the businesses that I have been in, or whatever businesses have come to me, whether they've been in real estate, whether they have been fractional CFOs or fractional CMOs, chief marketing officers or chief financial officers, people who are in the coffee business, people who are roofers, you know, different contractors and so forth. The VIP method works pretty well. Well, VIP stands for vision, infrastructure, process, and it has to go in that order. So vision is, we kind of talked about that here a little bit, but the vision piece is really specifically about what it is that you want to do. It doesn't have anything to do with income generation. So let's say, for argument's sake, you woke up with $30 million in your bank account and you get to decide day to day what your life would look like. And now, I mean, I think you and I both, Christine, we both know that $30 million, it sounds like a lot of money, but you can go through $30 million pretty quickly if you're not a good steward of money, right? Like it's
especially if you buy a yacht with a helipad.
Right.
That's like my husband's like, Like when I try to get him to dream, and I'm like, no, dream bigger, dream bigger. Then his joke is like, all right, I want an ocean-going vessel with a
Right,
helipad,
exactly.
which would probably cost, I don't even know how many millions of
Yeah,
dollars, like $50 million dollars.
yeah, probably something ridiculous. Yeah. Well, that like from that perspective, the vision piece is, you know, what would you want your day-to-day life to look like, you know, if your life wasn't defined by income generation? Because again, who we are is not what we do is not who we are. So
Yes.
start thinking about that. And many people say, well, what's a good way to start with that? Well, just think about your 100th birthday speech. You know, if you were 100, if you were turning 100, what would you say? What would you want said about you after you led the room and or you left the room? And what message would you want carried outside the room when you were done? So that's a really good way to do that in terms of the personal vision. Then you've got the other component of vision, which is your business vision. And I look at business vision a couple different ways. I like to look at it through the lens of three C's: core values, core purpose, and client avatar. You know, core values is specifically what does the business stand for? How would the world be worse off if you are no longer in business? Core purpose is what business are you specifically in? Not like, oh, I'm in real estate. No, well, what does that mean? You know, do you do commercial? Do you do residential? Do you do 3-bedroom, 2-bath houses? Like, what are you doing? Like, be really, really specific and don't be afraid to niche down. Because when you're too broad, again, you can wind up not being really specific on your third C, which is your client avatar. Because when you're really specific about your client avatar, like for my coaching, I really like working with business owners, like married business owners. I really like working with them. And specifically if they're married business owners with kids, even better, because I understand how busy they are, right? So I really like being really specific as much as I can around the client avatar that I like. So again, core purpose, core values, client avatar. And that encompasses your vision. Okay. Then you go to infrastructure. So that's vision. Next out of the VIP method is vision, then infrastructure. So infrastructure is the bones of the business. It's the desks, it's the chairs, it's the software, it's the websites, it's the phone system, and hopefully the phone system doesn't look like this, right? It's all of those things that are the infrastructure that you the bones of the business that runs, that also has to be in alignment with your vision. Because for example, if your vision is to lay on the beach rubbing cocoa butter on your belly, you know, and you've built an infrastructure that requires you to return emails and phone calls in a timely manner, that's gonna kind of suck for you when you want to lay on the beach rubbing cocoa butter on your belly, right? You're like, ah, oh, gotta wipe my hand
Exactly.
off again, you know, so I can answer my phone, right?
Exactly.
So that's the infrastructure. So the infrastructure has to be in alignment with the vision. And then finally is the process. So for any of the military folks out there, that's your SOPs, your standard operating procedures. It's how you do stuff. And it's the tactical stuff that you may learn from the gurus that you know, because there's lots of gurus out there that give really good advice, but it's not going to stick unless you have the infrastructure in place to run that tactic, and it's not going to work if it's not in alignment with your vision. So that's why I say start with your vision first, then create the infrastructure that you want that's in alignment with that vision, and then create processes that runs on that infrastructure that you create that all stays in alignment with your vision for the future.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like a lot of people do that in a piecemeal kind of way. You know, it's like they kind of do those things on the fly. You know, they're adding procedures as a reaction. You know, they're adding infrastructure because there's a bottleneck rather than like stepping back and looking at everything. And so I love that that is what you help your clients do, whether it is, you know, on the real estate side or in business in general. Mark, thank you so much for
This
being
has
here
been
today. I know we could talk for hours and hours, but
great.
unfortunately, we don't have that kind of time.
I get it, yeah.
But I think this has truly been an eye-opening and fun-filled conversation about the world of real estate and business. And I'm sure our audience has gained some valuable insights and, you know, what it takes to be a landlord. And certainly, we're going to put the link for your VIP method course for landlords because I'm sure there's going to be some people that want to take advantage of that. And I know that our producer Bill has been eavesdropping on our conversation. He is dying to chime in.
Well, first of all, that is a great story, and thank you. Again, part of me was sitting here wondering where you were a few decades ago, because my wife and I became the sort of accidental reluctant landlord when we had some property that we couldn't sell at a gain. we thought, well, we'll be a landlord for a little while and create an income for ourselves. And we're never going to repeat that.
How hard could it be, Bill? Come on, we can do this. We're smart people.
But that's actually my question is a people question, because I know we're talking about business. So let's incorporate people into this. As a matter of fact, our first tenants were remarkable. They couldn't have been more ideal. They were perfect. Mm-hmm. They were wonderful. And it spoiled us. And then our second set of tenants were a nightmare. Yeah. And it's what convinced us to get out of this experiment, as a matter of fact. So how do you deal? I don't know if you can answer this question, but it's like, how do you deal with the people side of this business equation? Because they're very much people involved.
Yeah, this is a people business. There's no getting around that. And I think that's where a lot of people think like, oh, I'm getting into real estate because I don't like people. And then I'm like, wait, what?
You heard that, listeners. If you don't like people, do not get into landlording. Well, landlording is not for you.
Well, it's not for you if you want to be, you know, involved in the day-to-day. Maybe go be an actuary or go build kites, you know, sell ice cream cones, something else. But don't do that, because you're dealing with literally the hardest parts of people and how they live and how they raise their kids and how they, I mean, just all the things that come swirling around. And of course, every single person that's come to me that with a regret that says, yeah, I knew I shouldn't have rented to them, but I felt bad for the kids. You know, I felt so sorry for them. You know, and of course, many of them have even, you know, they may even have a little training for the kids. Oh, let's put on our sad faces, kids, so we can, you know, guilt the landlord into renting to us. And I will tell you this, there are many folks out there that specifically look for rental properties that are owned by private landlords. And that's because they know they are not sophisticated in their credit screening, their background checks, things like that. They just kind of go by the seat of their pants, and they just, you know, I mean, and they'll convince you, oh, they're the best tenants since Mary and Joseph rented the manger, you know, and you're like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
Amazing, you know, and all of a sudden you're like, sweet baby Jesus, how do we get rid of these?
That is true.
It is a thing though, in terms of that. And let me just ask this. And I know you asked a very specific question. I'll have to give a broad answer just for the sake of time, but think about this, you know, think of other businesses that manage humans and human behavior, right? You've got credit card companies, you've got utility companies, you've got mortgage companies that they're all kind of dealing with the same thing in very similar ways, like hospitality. I came out of the hospitality industry. I was an assistant controller for Marriott for a while. So all of those things like kind of gave me this background in dealing with this, the insanity of the human condition at times. But I would say like that the systems is what will set you free on that. And you have to stick to your systems, because every single time I've gone outside my system is when I have gotten messed up and I got upside down. So once I create that system, that's why, again, the system part of the VIP method is infrastructure and process. So the system part would be, okay, so when you come to me, I have a checklist that says, okay, I need a photo ID from every adult. Okay, that's going to be on the lease. And everybody that's 18 or above has to be listed on the lease. I need to make sure that I'm running credit checks on this and that and the other thing. And I need to make sure that I have a month's worth of income, right? That statements, bank statements, but
pay stubs,
there it is. month worth of pay stubs from each one of these individual people, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? So all of that is very checklist driven. Whereas if I'm flying by the seat of my pants because it's fun and it's exciting and how hard could it be? And they seem like such nice people, you know, that's when you get upside down. So create the systems that'll protect you from yourself.
Yeah.
Great, great. Again, I wish you were around a few decades ago.
I've heard that so many times.
Thanks so much. That was really great.
Happy to help.
Awesome. Yeah. And Christine, thanks for facilitating this conversation, because as always, this podcast is invaluable. It is really a terrific advice-filled podcast, if you will. And that leads me to this question for those of you listening today. If you're not a subscriber, why not? All you have to do is hit the subscribe button. It's really very easy. Hit it, subscribe, and then this podcast will always be delivered to you wherever you listen to it, and you won't miss another episode. That's pretty easy in terms of everything that's been talked about today, okay? Thank you so much for listening. If you like it, share this podcast with other people. Let them know. Spread the word about it. get the word out. On behalf of Christine, I'm Bill Tucker, the producer, thanking you for listening and reminding you that you can go out today and make it an absolute great day or not. It is your choice. Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening to the Money is Emotional podcast. To get in touch, visit our website at www.christinelukin.com or drop us a line at hello@christinelukin.com. And don't forget to click the follow button to be notified when new episodes become available. The information covered and posted represents the views and opinions of the guest and does not necessarily represent the views or opinions of Christine Lukin. The content has been made available for informational and educational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional investing or tax advice. Always seek the advice of your advisor, tax professional, or other qualified financial professional with any questions you may have regarding your personal finances.